this entire scheme is, you know, exactly what the Supreme Court warned against in Arizona. The Supreme Court said the federal government has to have control over the immigration system.
Department of Justice attorney Daniel Tenney arguing before the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals today. He wants the court to strike down a Texas law that would allow state police to arrest people they suspect of crossing into the U.S. illegally. The law, known as Senate Bill 4, also gives state judges the authority to deport people. And groups like the ACLU say the law is a violation of civil rights. The Biden administration says it takes away their power to enforce immigration policy. Aaron Nielsen, the Solicitor General for the Lone Star State, says the federal government isn't doing enough.
Texas has a right to defend itself. And under any plausible reading of that right, at least some applications of SB 4 are constitutional.
The law briefly took effect yesterday when the U.S. Supreme Court declined to block it. Then the Fifth Circuit put it on hold again ahead of today's oral arguments. We're going to look into the politics and legality surrounding all of this now with Kathleen Campbell Walker. She's an immigration attorney based in El Paso, Texas, where she's been following all of this. Welcome to Press Play, Kathleen.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Really happy to have you here. So can you kind of unpack for us, what is Texas trying to do with this? What is SB 4 saying and what is its purpose?
SB 4 allows Texas to create three new state laws that are typically laws that you would see at the federal level, and they exist currently. One is you enter the state of Texas illegally between ports of entry. Another is you try to reenter the state of Texas illegally between our ports of entry. And finally, if you refuse to return to the foreign nation you came from illegally. All three new criminal matters. And what's SB 4 trying to do? It's setting a marker down on the issue of federal preemption regarding federal immigration law. Similar to what SB 1070 did way back in 2010, but very different. It is it's a very targeted approach versus what happened back with the Arizona law.
Well, before we move on to that, just from a practical perspective, would the state be jailing suspected undocumented migrants or deporting them immediately? Like, who would determine whether a migrant has authorization under this law? How would they be sent back to Mexico? Do we know any of that?
We can speculate on the ground what's supposed to happen according to what's currently in SB 4. So the idea is that it doesn't have to be at the border. I don't have to see somebody crossing into the state of Texas between ports of entry necessarily, but I have to have probable cause for arresting them on this state law. Let's say that I've arrested them. I don't have to, as a state law enforcement official, consider their immigration status. I just get to arrest them because I see them cross between the ports of entry, for example. And then I can take them down to local county jail, and I can be brought up before a hearing a few days later or that day. Who knows how this will work out? But there is no consideration of whether or not I'm lawfully in the United States, whether or not I have a pending asylum claim, whether or not I can make an asylum claim. None of that is considered at the time of arrest.
So you mentioned SB 1070. This is the Arizona law that was struck down by the Supreme Court in 2012, or largely struck down. One of the provisions they struck down allowed state police to arrest suspected undocumented immigrants. So it seems like precedent is clear here. And as you said, this law goes even further. Why is it even a question as to whether this is constitutional if we had that previous case?
I think two factors. One is that the state of Texas believes that the federal government has not executed its responsibility to control the border, and therefore Texas has to protect its citizens, and they are stepping in that circumstance by creating a law that creates a state offense for their arrest authority. So that's what's going on. I mean, bottom line, they believe that they have a potential chance to have the analysis placed on the SB 1070 law reviewed and potentially overturned. Do I think it should be successful? No. Do I still think it's field preemption and this is going to create a real mess as far as any kind of enforcement authority? Yes.
Yeah.
I do.
I mean, it is a different Supreme Court now than it was a decade ago. I mean, is that why Governor Greg Abbott is pushing this? Because he thinks he might find a different outcome with the Supreme Court?
I think that's part of it. I think also he thinks that this SB4 is on steroids as far as a direct challenge on this federal preemption area in light of the problems that we're having on enforcement and individuals that are trying to come to the United States to claim asylum between ports of entry. But of course, this state law would allow Texas to potentially arrest somebody for coming into the United States, maybe at a gate they've been told to come to on the CBP-1 app that they're using right now for this federal process. And so the ports of entry are what Texas focuses on. If you do not enter the United States through a port of entry, then you are subject to this law.
Wow.
And further, if I have a reasonable suspicion and you happen to be in Austin right next to the Capitol, that doesn't protect you against this arrest authority either. Interior of Texas.
Mm-hmm. Right. It sounds like it could create a big mess, especially if the federal government is telling migrants one thing and Texas is telling them another. I mean, clearly Republicans want to run on immigration. Abbott has seemed like he's really spoiling for a fight with the administration. On the other hand, we've seen, you know, the feds push back against sanctuary cities in states like in California, where I'm sitting. What do you think the federal government wants to happen here?
The federal government, what do they want to have? Well, I mean, bottom line, I think it's already been stated in the arguments that the federal government is saying we need to speak with one voice. This is a complicated area. It's subject to international law and conventions to which the United States is a party. Texas is still part of the United States. They don't get to, you know, act on their own, so that we have a patchwork quilt regarding a federal immigration matter. But the argument from, of course, Abbott is that you guys are not doing what you're supposed to do regarding enforcing federal immigration law. This is opening the door to our argument. So I think what also is a problem here, of course, is that Congress hasn't acted. We've allowed this festering wound of dysfunctional immigration law that's not responsive to security issues, not responsive to economic needs, not responsive to family being unified. All of that has just been ignored. And yeah, we're at a boiling point. Go figure.
Yeah. I mean, do you think there's any chance this could get decided before this fall's election?
Wow. All I can think that could be decided before the election definitely is whether or not they're going to issue an actual stay to keep the injunction in place and not allow this to go forward and put it on a slow boat. So we'll see. I mean, I can't imagine that the Supreme Court, if they look at this again on the stay, would not uphold the stay. As far as a decision before November, I think that's extremely unlikely.
Kathleen Campbell Walker is an immigration attorney based in El Paso, Texas, and the former president of the American Immigration Lawyers Association. Thanks so much for being with us today, Kathleen.
Appreciate your time.
For a while, it seemed like nothing was safe from the culture wars between red and blue America. Education, medicine, parenting, even dog training wasn't immune to the so-called war on woke. But lately, even with the 2024 election in full swing, there have been signs that these once red-hot fights might be starting to cool. A Florida court settlement neutered that state's so-called Don't Say Gay law, rolling back key provisions that limited what students and teachers can talk about in the classroom. And here in California, voters recently ousted a pair of school board candidates who'd made anti-LGBTQ policies a tentpole of their tenure. They were on an Orange County school district. Blake Jones covers education in California for Politico and joins me now to talk about this. Welcome back, Blake.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So you write that last year, California conservatives secured some major victories in public schools, but this red wave may be receding. How were they successful and what were they successful in achieving? And any sense on why that tide might be turning?
Yeah. So last year, they were successful in you know, spreading these policies on transgender students that had become more common in states like Florida, that essentially required school staff to alert a parent if a child shows signs of being transgender. Now, those policies only spread to about 7 or 8 of the state's nearly 1,000 school districts. So it's important to note that this flurry of policies last year was not a red wave that took over the entire state, but they did secure some victories that created a lot of noise. Now, we're already starting to see the pushback, as you know, you noted. And we saw this first in Orange Unified, a pretty small district in, you know, politically contested territory where these two trustees who passed one of these trans student policies have, you know, been ousted with just a few votes left to count.
Is there a reason? This is the city of Orange and Orange County we're talking about, and they became one of the flashpoints here in California. Did they actually succeed in enacting these policies?
Yes, they did. They were one of these handful of districts that successfully implemented one of those trans student policies. And we should note that the thing that actually spurred the recall that was cited by organizers was their firing of the district superintendent shortly after a 4-3 conservative majority took over the board, though. So there is more than just LGBTQ policies that were at play here.
Interesting. So those most sort of controversial school board members, Rick Ledesma and Madison Minor, were recalled. I think it's been called by a couple outlets. I know there's also an election coming up in Temecula where we've seen sort of similar types of school board members run for office. Do you think California does not have an appetite to really politicize these kind of culture wars within education?
Yeah, I think that we can infer that, especially in moderate parts of the state, that there's been a really organized resistance against this kind of politicization of education. And, you know, the election that you talked about in Temecula is going to be another good litmus test of California voters' appetites because, you know, Temecula is a really historically conservative part of the Inland Empire, but it has become a lot more moderate in the last few years with some demographic change. And the situation there is really similar. This new conservative school board comes in, campaigns on anti-COVID protocol sort of platform, campaigns on these gender-related issues. They fire their superintendent, they ban critical race theory, and now that majority is actually dissipated there, by the way, because one of the 3 conservatives resigned and moved his family to Texas. But we still do have this 2-2 gridlock and the board chair there who went viral for calling Harvey Milk a pedophile during a school board meeting is now facing this recall in June that'll give us another gauge from voters.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned the factor of organization. And I think a lot of Democrats and folks on the left felt like they were out organized for a year or two kind of heading out of COVID. But on the other hand, some of these same activists that helped, you know, run these school board campaigns around the state are struggling to get an initiative on the ballot that would ban gender affirming care for minors, place gender restrictions on school sports and require parental notification about trans kids in schools. I'm just curious, like, what does that tell you that they're struggling to get these signatures? And even if they could, I mean, is there any world in which this could pass in a state like California?
I think it tells us 2 things. One is that California has a pretty liberal electorate, which is not a surprise to probably anyone listening. But, you know, another thing that it tells us, too, is that there aren't a lot of deep pocketed funders in California who have been willing to pay to get an initiative like this on the ballot, which, you know, probably says that they're evaluating its chances of success in California and, you know, not seeing a clear pathway there.
I mean, that also might tell you something more broadly about the politics of this, right? Because if it was seen as such a like winning national issue, you might have deeper pockets kind of backing this, especially in a state like California. Like, wouldn't that be the biggest win in some ways for the movement to get something like that passed in deep blue golden state?
I think that's absolutely right. If they did see an opportunity here, but it seems like they don't. And there are a variety of reasons why that might be. Even in more moderate states, in fact, you've seen, you know, some of these similar kind of conservative education culture warriors suffering some defeats. For example, in Virginia, where Glenn Youngkin really famously won the governor's election, talking a lot about, you know, quote unquote, parental rights. Even there, you have since seen a lot of school board candidates who were aligned with him ousted from office as the kind of angst over coronavirus protocols has waned. So there has been a little bit of a national current, I think, away from, these kind of policies.
Yeah, well, let's talk about the national politics here. I mean, we saw book bannings around the country. We talked about the Don't Say Gay law in Florida that's been severely cut back, not eliminated entirely. I mean, how do you see this playing out nationally as we approach this presidential election?
So you're definitely seeing the Trump campaign talking a lot about transgender students in particular and some of these red meat kind of issues. You know, if you also look at Trump's plan for education when he is, you know, if he is elected, then, you know, he's planned to use the education department in even more sweeping ways to push toward curriculum restrictions. And, you know, I think that what that tells you is that he sees this as an issue that can motivate his base. I don't see Democrats talking about it a whole lot, especially the Biden campaign. So, you know, I wouldn't go as far as to say that this is going to be a swing issue for moderate voters who are probably a lot more concerned about things like crime and the economy that are shown to, you know, be a lot more motivating at the polls.
That is Blake Jones. He covers California education for Politico. Thanks so much for joining us, Blake.
Thank you.
Coming up, as the violent political crisis in Haiti worsens, we speak with a pro-democracy activist in Port-au-Prince about what comes next. And a conversation with comedian Julio Torres about his new film, Problemista, which he wrote, directed, and stars in. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Marisa Lagos, in for Madeline Brand. For weeks now, absolute chaos has engulfed Haiti. Dozens have been killed as armed gangs run the streets and attack government buildings, burning police stations, storming prisons, and releasing thousands of prisoners, even shutting down the main airport in Port-au-Prince at one point. The country's prime minister has said he'll resign, although it's not clear when that might take effect. Joining us now from Haiti is Monique Klaiska. She's a pro-democracy activist in Haiti and a former UN official. Monique, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
First, could you just tell us what it's like there right now? How are you coping? How are others doing?
It's very difficult, and I think that is an understatement. We are coping with great anxiety, with great trepidation, it's just very difficult.
The airport is still
closed. It's been closed for 2 weeks. I was supposed to leave for Miami last Saturday and the flights are canceled. Now, the situation, there was a massacre 3 nights ago where a gunman just killed 13 people in one street corner. The gangs they attack the neighborhood where I live. And there were a few people who died. There was a woman and some children who died. Yesterday when I went to the market, I passed a corpse on the street that was killed, somebody who was killed by the gunman. And last night they attacked some different neighborhoods, maybe half an hour from me. So you never know when they will attack, even though they threaten to attack while they are saying they are apologizing for our suffering and they are branding their movement Living Together. But you never know. Every day there is something new and there is no government to help. The police is overrun And that is the situation. So we are not being helped. We are helpless, and we are helpless in every sense of the way.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just, Monique, this is I can't imagine what it's like being there. And I know in 2010, the earthquake devastated Haiti. There have been political crises before. The president was assassinated in 2021. Does this feel different than past times of upheaval?
Yes, it does. Because the earthquake, well, first of all, it was a natural disaster. This one is a man-made disaster, so that is different. With the earthquake, you know that, you know, we can eventually rebuild, and you know that some things will be taken away, everything that fell apart, probably you can take it away, maybe you can rebuild your house, etc. But now what has happened is that when gangs take over neighborhoods, people leave those neighborhoods, people run away from two other places. They run away to family, they run away maybe to the provinces if they manage to get through, because the gangs have blocked access to the north of Port-au-Prince and to the south, which means that you basically have three countries in Haiti now. You have the northern part with four geographical departments, you have the southern part, and then you have the Port-au-Prince metropolitan area with about 4 million people. So I have images of about 12 gang members breaking into a home 10 minutes from where I live. So they could have come up, even though in the area there is resistance, in that we have put up some barricades, you break, you know, trees on the ground, huge rocks, boulders even on the ground, you know, tires on the ground to prevent them from coming or to slow them down. But still, they have machine guns, they are masked, and they are in the streets. In plain daylight. We're not talking about nighttime. Right. We're talking about daylight.
It's a horrific. And I know that they have been among those, the gang leaders pressuring the president, Ariel Henry, to step aside. They've warned of the potential of civil war and genocide. What do these gangs want to see happen? Are they united in any way politically?
Well, they say they are united. And I think it is this united living together that really kind of undid the prime minister, Ariel Henry, because there had been quite a lot of movements, including the Montana movement that I'm part of, which have been advocating for 2.5 years for a transition to a cleaner, a non-criminal, non-corrupt regime. But what I think is important for your listeners to know is that the gangs may be independent now, but some of them were created by government officials. Well, a UN report says even a president created a gang. Some of them were armed by government officials. They were empowered by government officials or by people in the economic sector, private sector. Even a bank director was named in sanctions by Canada. So we are talking about a criminal regime that is heading the country, that is managing the country with the gangs. And at a certain point, apparently the gangs perhaps became emboldened and kind of split from part of the regime. Have they split from the whole regime or not? I do not know. But what I know is it is chaos.
Yeah.
And it is terrifying.
Horrifying. So I know that Prime Minister Henry has said he would step aside. He's in exile in Puerto Rico. The U.S. is, Republicans here are holding up aid. I understand there's some African countries, including Kenya, that have promised troops and money. Do you expect that we could see an election? I mean, what do you think is ahead? We have about a minute left, Monique.
Listen, I can't even go to the supermarket without thinking that I'm running into a gang. So there is no way that there can be elections right now. Elections are way off. You need a political accord. You need to establish peace and security. You need to deal with the massive humanitarian situation, people displaced, women and girls raped, about 4 million hungry. And then you can start.
I think we may have lost Monique. Monique Kleska is a pro-democracy activist in Haiti and a former UN official. She was speaking to us from Port-au-Prince. Tomorrow on Press Play, film critics Sean Edwards and Monica Castillo are here to talk new releases, including the new Ghostbusters movie, Frozen Empire. And it's Women's History Month. Evan Kleiman will tell us about some special events celebrating female-owned restaurants. Coming up next, Julio Torres tapped Tilda Swinton to star in his debut feature film, Problemista. It's a humorous and surreal take on the morass of the U.S. immigration system.
And I feel like every artist knows what I'm talking about, there's no guarantee that any of your hopes and dreams will happen, but you need to find joy in the process.
That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Marisa Lagos in for Madeline Brandt. In the new movie Problemista, a Salvadoran immigrant named Alejandro longs to become a successful toy designer when he arrives in New York. But the challenges of getting an American work visa threaten to derail his dreams. Then he meets Elizabeth, a messy art world eccentric played by Tilda Swinton.
They didn't want to sponsor me anymore. I'm actually from El Salvador.
Oh, El Salvador. Pupusas.
Yes.
And those nuns they killed in the 80s, yes.
Right. So now I'm looking for a new job.
Oh, you are?
That will maybe sponsor me.
Oh, well, I'm not sure I could offer anything formal, but maybe freelance?
Elizabeth eventually become Alejandro's only hope to stay in the country. Julio Torres wrote, directed, and stars in the movie. He's known for his work as a writer on SNL and for co-creating the HBO show Los Espookies. He also emigrated from El Salvador before establishing a career in comedy. And Julio Torres joins me now. Welcome to Press Play.
Hi. Hi, Marissa.
So that clip we just heard from, you have Tilda Swinton's character kind of boiling down El Salvador into two familiar tropes. But of course, the bigger conflict in this story is Alejandro's need to get a visa sponsor. Can you just talk about, like, did his struggles obtaining a visa mirror anything in your own experience?
Yeah, I mean, the story, or the skeleton of it at least, is very, very connected to my own journey, having to go from a, or not having to, but wanting to go from a student visa to a work visa, as opposed to leaving the U.S. And I really wanted to make something that dissects how that felt and the sort of like the lessons learned from that, and you know, seeing it through a comedic, odd, some might say surrealist lens.
Yeah, it's definitely funny and a little surreal. I want to play another clip from the film here. In it, Alejandro is climbing through this endless maze of rooms. It is a surreal moment meant to depict the immigration process. And the voice here is Isabella Rossellini, who's the narrator in the film.
The rules of the game are as follows. First, he must find a sponsor for a work visa. Then he must submit it by paying application and lawyer fees, totaling up to around $6,000. And only then is Alejandro allowed to earn money. Money that he needs so he can submit his application to, well, earn money. and he must do it before the fall of the last grain of sand. The maze is impossible to navigate, unless, of course, he's willing to bend the rules. Cash. You need cash.
So, I mean, that in itself, Julio, just shows how difficult the process is. But you kind of make it visually surreal, almost psychedelic at times. Talk about that choice. Like, why did you want to do that?
Well, because I was interested in depicting things as how they feel. And I think that anyone who has felt trapped within a maze of bureaucracy and has been made to feel small from it can really relate to that. And I didn't set off to make a movie that was weird or to show interesting visuals for the sake of showing interesting visuals. They're always done hopefully in service to a human emotion. And I think that to some extent we've all felt like trapped in a maze that doesn't make sense. It just happens to be that this visa conundrum was the card that was dealt to me. As the lawyer in the movie articulates, you have to come up with money to pay for a work visa, but you need a work visa in order to make money. So it's like, okay, well, this doesn't make sense.
Yeah, totally. And the bureaucracy is very real. I know, like, you did stand-up comedy earlier in your career. I'm curious how that sort of fit into your life as you were dealing with this immigration maze. Did it feel like an escape of any sort?
Oh, I wasn't really doing it during the time that I was trying to get a work visa. I wasn't trying to do it yet. I think that my whole creative life was, I feel like, in some way put on hold in order for me to like resolve the like, will I be able to stay here? And once I felt like the ground beneath me wasn't eroding and I was capable of being here, that I was like, okay, now I can finally dive into my creative self. Anyone that's like looking for work knows that looking for work is a full-time job. And when you add to that you have to find work that will sponsor you being here, which most employers don't want to because it's costly and because, you know, most employers don't want a background check from the FBI.
Right.
But yeah, it was just all time consuming. There just weren't enough hours in the day.
Absolutely. Well, I want to ask you about a subplot. The immigration journey is really the main sort of centerpiece, but Tilda Swinton's spouse in the movie has cancer and has been frozen in a cryogenic facility so he can come back to life in the future. He's actually played by RZA from the Wu-Tang Clan. How on earth did you come up with that whole concept of the cryogenic freezing and like this idea of sort of delaying somebody's life into the future?
Well, because it feels like it really mirrored the immigration process a little bit in that totally. It's crazy, it doesn't make sense, but hope has to be the thing that got you through it, and you have to be slightly delusional in order to make it. And I see Rissa's character, Bobby, as immigrating to the future, where there's no guarantee that he'll make it, but that's where his heart tells him he has to be.
That's amazing. Well, Tilda Swinton's character, Elizabeth, is so bombastic in this film. Although I think we all know somebody a little like her, maybe. She's kind of reminiscent of Meryl Streep in The Devil Wears Prada.
Like her deranged, not put together
cousin or something. Yeah, because nobody respects her. Yeah.
Yeah, no one respects her. No.
She also has this like kind of sweet side, though. So I'm curious, like, did you model her off of anybody? Is there anyone in your life like this? Or how did that kind of come into your mind?
She's an amalgamation of people. She's just a collection of different people that I've encountered. And part of me is in her as well. And then once Tilda embodied her, she changed a little more. So she's a tribute to difficult people for sure.
What was it like working with Tilda Swinton and acting opposite of her?
Absolute joy. She's, I didn't realize when I first started talking to her that I had found someone who is so compatible in terms of like the way that she wants to do work. And that's like with friends. She wants, she's attracted to a project because it sounds interesting, not because it can like get her anything. Mm. And I don't know, that's such a beautiful, unpretentious reason to make work.
If you're just joining me, my guest is Julio Torres. His new film, Problemista, is a surrealist comedy that tackles the U.S. immigration system. You know, another character that you sort of repeatedly center in the film is Alejandro's mother and his relationship with her. She's an artist still back in El Salvador. She's played by Catalina Saavedra. And she had created this really safe fantasy world for Alejandro when he was a child in the film. But it struck me that he's sort of protecting her at points from how dire things are in New York. I wonder if that tension felt familiar at all, given your own immigration story.
Oh, completely. I mean, there were moments where I wouldn't, I don't know, that's a very familiar thing, right? Yeah. It's like you go away and then you don't tell your parents everything you're up to because they'll freak out. I think it's a form of like protecting each other. And I think the part of it is that you don't want to hear that's too much, come back. Like that's the last thing you want to hear. So you just don't want to give that opportunity.
Yeah, it's a really sweet relationship between them. Let's play another clip. This is another surreal moment when you're arguing with Tilda Swinton's character and she offers a big dose of reality.
Why are you making everything so difficult?
Oh, that's rich coming from you. You, who adore difficulty. You cannot get enough of it. You seek it out around every corner. Not Mexico City, not Montreal, not Berlin. Nowhere easy to migrate to. I'm not a doctor, not a software designer. Nothing that anybody is gleefully handing out visas for. No, an aspiring maker of toys.
So you were an aspiring maker of toys. And you said earlier you have to be a little delusional to make it as an immigrant in this country. I'm assuming this, again, is a parallel with your real life comedy sort of journey, that maybe at times it felt like, why am I doing this?
Yeah, I mean, it's you have to set out to do this even when the likelihood is that it's not going to work out, right? And I feel like every artist knows what I'm talking about of... there's no guarantee that any of your hopes and dreams will happen, but you need to find joy in the process and not see something as means to an end, but like really enjoying what you're doing. And yeah, that's what I mean by slightly delusional, is that being an artist is not getting a degree and then you're an artist, right? It's like, yeah, who knows?
Well, and I mean, on the other hand too, like this is... there are heavy moments to this film, but you don't take like a heavy hand in what is obviously a very serious and sometimes life and death situation for folks. Was that intentional too, that you wanted people to sort of find some joy and laughter out of all of this? I mean, you are a comedian.
Yeah, I mean, that's what felt honest to me. It's like the kind of work that comes out of me. It's the only way that I know how to tell things. So it just, I don't know. It was like there was no other option.
Well, this is a lovely film, but it comes out at a time where we're seeing debates over immigration and border policy grip the U.S. And they've boiled over in places very far from the border, like New York City. I mean, beyond just the difficulty of navigating the process, sort of spelling out that bureaucratic maze, what do you hope people take from this film? What do you want people to think about more when we talk about the immigrant experience?
I think to challenge conventional thought and challenge that idea that helping people is to the detriment of the country, and that challenge this idea that it's a completely abstract and see the real human beings that are affected by it.
Yeah. Well, I'm very glad it worked out for you. You made it happen in comedy and film. I'm looking forward to what's next for you. Thanks for being here today, Julio.
Thank you so much.
That's Julio Torres. His new film is called Problemista. It's in theaters now. Coming up on Press Play, Shohei Ohtani makes his Dodgers debut while Mookie Betts moves to shortstop. And March Madness has arrived. The Sklar brothers are here to break it all down. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Marisa Lago, sitting in for Madeline Brand. Baseball's opening day isn't officially until next week, with the exception of what took place overnight in South Korea.
Bouncer, Gavin Lux, running throw to end the game. And the Dodgers start this highly anticipated 2024 season with a 5-2 win over the Padres in Seoul.
The Dodgers made an eighth-inning comeback to beat my hometown San Diego Padres in the first of a two-game regular season series. It was the Dodger debut of Shohei Ohtani, the Japanese sensation who hits, pitches, and apparently recently had a super private wedding we only learned about from Instagram. Here to talk about Ohtani's debut, plus March Madness and other sports stuff, are Randy and Jason Sklar. They host a podcast called View from the Cheap Seats. Hey, guys.
Hi, Marisa. How are you?
Great. Well, let's talk about this Japanese star. Ohtani coming off an elbow injury, so he won't be pitching this year. But this is the biggest debut of a Dodger player maybe in ever. Tell us about Ohtani mania and what's been happening in spring training in today's game.
First of all, he went 2-for-5 in his first game, so he's already batting 400. And he didn't really, you know, he didn't hit any home runs, but he was part of the eighth inning rally where they came back and they beat your Padres. I'm very sorry. But he adds so much excitement to this team. But with excitement come high expectations. And Randy and I have been talking about this. You know, I can't even remember a season where there were higher expectations for the Dodgers, and they've had high expectations going into recent seasons. This is an all-in win the World Series or bust season for the Dodgers, and it's a lot of pressure.
Yeah, Shohei Ohtani played his recent seasons with the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim. I don't even know the name.
He was basically
wherever they are. Wherever they are, we know the Angels. Yeah,
it's in the Southern California Angels. Pick a name, everybody. But I'm just saying he was playing in a market where they weren't expected to win. The Dodgers have such high expectations because they have MVP candidates like Mookie Betts and Freddie Freeman, and you still have tremendous star power with Clayton Kershaw.
Walker Buehler.
There are incredible players on this Dodgers team. This Dodgers team is built to win. They are, and with Shohei Ohtani, imagine they're building for the future. They're going to sell out almost all their games. He's going to sell out when he's on the road. There's going to be a much brighter light on this kid, which I'm very excited about. We've said it many times before. It's like watching Babe Ruth. He's the last great player who hit the way he hit and pitched the way he pitched, except Shohei Ohtani can throw 100 miles an hour. It's going to be exciting when he does pitch, but this season is going to be incredible. And you saw a little bit of it last night.
Well, speaking of high expectations, Mookie Betts, the all-star outfielder, is now the Dodgers' starting shortstop, a position he hasn't played full-time since high school. That feels like a high risk, high reward bet there.
He's played the infield before and played infield with the Boston Red Sox. So he's just an unbelievable player. And again,
he's the guy who will do whatever it takes to win. That's the guy. As much as Shohei Ohtani is a guy you're looking to be a leader and to take the Dodgers across the finish line, I look at a guy like Mookie Betts, who has done it before, and he is one of those glue guys who's like, what do I need to do? You tell me what I need to do.
You want me to lead off? I'll lead off. You want me to play shortstop? I'll play shortstop. Where can I be? Where can I fit in best? And he will be great. He'll be a great shortstop. Is he going to be the best fielding shortstop you've ever seen? Probably not, but he will hold it down, and he'll be great, and he's just one of those guys. And I think Shohei Ohtani coming to the Dodgers takes a little bit of pressure off of the Mookie Betts's and Freddie Freeman's on this team, that like, hey, there's another guy who's getting all the reporters over there. I can just relax and do my job. And both those guys are just, I mean, they're MVP candidates year in and year out.
Well, before we move on, the LA Times had a headline saying these Dodgers could be historic or another October disaster in the making if they underperform. Not that I want to, you know, say that, but would manager Dave Roberts lose his job?
I don't think he'll lose his job, because you're going to sell out. The Dodgers are going to be making a lot of money. Yes, they have to pay a lot of money, but the problem is with baseball is it's not necessarily about the best team. It's about who gets hot during playoff time. You look at a team like the Arizona Diamondbacks last year. They lost 27 out of some ungodly games in July, and you thought this team is dead. Then they came back, and they really got hot at the end of the season. They did just enough to get into the playoffs, and then they made it to the World Series, and they became a buzzsaw. So the question is, can the Dodgers, we know they're going to have a good regular season. They'll probably end up in first place in their division. The question is, can they get hot or be good enough to stave off the hot team on the way to the World Series?
All right. And as you pointed out, lots of time ahead for Ohtani as well, not just this season. All right. Let's switch gears. March Madness kicked off yesterday. Everyone's been filling out their brackets. And this year, the women's tournament seems like it's the one to watch. USC is a top seed. UCLA is a second seed. A lot to root for LA fans. But all eyes are really on Iowa and their superstar player, Caitlin Clark, right?
Caitlin Clark is amazing, and she is, in my opinion, you know, you're watching one of the best players of all time play the game right now. She's just got an incredible shot. For those who haven't seen her play, I would sort of compare her game, if you're looking for a player that you want to recognize in the, on the men's side in the NBA, Steph Curry, great example.
I was about to ask that, yeah.
She's got a quick release. It doesn't matter if there's a hand in her face. She gets it up. Her shot is pure. She doesn't care about it. She's like, give me the ball at the end of the game. I will sink the shot that wins the game. She's got ice water in her veins. She trash talks a little bit. I love this woman. She is a great player and a great athlete and someone that has huge star power. She is going to, in my opinion, when she gets in the WNBA, help really take that league to the next level. And then there are other teams. I mean, there's South Carolina seems unbeatable. We're talking about Caitlin Clark as maybe the GOAT, maybe one of the best college basketball players of all time. And you look over at South Carolina, you're like, I don't know how Iowa beat South Carolina. And South Carolina just beat LSU. And there was pushing and shoving in that game. And the coach, Kim Mulkey of LSU, got on the mic in the press conference afterwards. And instead of playing it down like Dawn Staley, the coach of South Carolina, Kim Mulkey stoked the flames. And you're like, this is a rivalry I want to see maybe in the Final Four.
So we're sitting here saying, okay, there are a lot of great men's teams. Yes, UConn, who won it all last year, they may be there in
yes,
the end.
Yes, Duke is in there. Yes, North Carolina's in
there. Yes, Purdue has a shot to be great, even though it's a one seed. They lost to a 16 seed last year. So there's good storylines. But I'm telling you,
I want to see Caitlin Clark. To me, I'm like, I want to see Caitlin Clark win it all. That would be great. But I'm telling you, South Carolina LSU rematch, I'm all in for that game more than any game in the men's bracket.
Well, I got to say, as you know, we're big Warriors fans in my house. She just passed Steph Curry's NCAA record. So a lot of exciting things ahead for Caitlin Clark. I want to switch to the men's tournament before I let you guys go. Neither UCLA nor USC qualified this year. Only Cal State Long Beach locally. What's the pitch for LA basketball fans to watch the men's tournament?
I mean, Cal State Long Beach they fired their coach.
This is the best story ever. Okay.
And then he did enough after he was fired to play out the rest of the season to get them in the tournament. That's like saying to someone, hey, you know, we just fired you, but you need to go into that company and make the big presentation because you got the team together. It's like, what? How is this guy still coaching for his players? He's coaching for his team. What if they get to the Sweet 16? Who knows? This is a good Long Beach State team. They beat Michigan earlier in the year, which turned out to be not such a great win. But look, they are moving into this tournament. Right now, there's parity in men's college basketball. Look at a team like McNeese State. That's a team, that's a school that we don't say often.
Where?
Tell me where McNeese State
they
is.
They have the coach, Will Wade, who used to coach at LSU, and he's got that team in good shape.
Here are the teams you want to look for. Auburn has a chance to make a run. I would look at Marquette. They have a chance to make a deep run with a great coach.
And I've got a dark horse. Iowa State. With Coach T.J. Otzelberger.
Remember,
that's right. Otzelberger is the name you're going to whisper on your lips as you put your head on the pillow at night.
Otzelberger. That's right. Iowa State, great defense. It's an exciting tournament. So while the women's side is very top-heavy and has real star power, what's exciting for the men's side is that
there's
so much parity. Anyone can win, and this is just going to be the most exciting. It's the most wonderful time of the year
if you're a
basketball fan.
All right, we're going to leave it there. Randy and Jason Sklar, check out their podcast, View from the Cheap Seats. Thank you both, as always.
Thanks, Marisa.
That does it for Press Play today. Thanks for listening. Don't forget, you can download or subscribe to the Press Play podcast at kcrw.com/pressplay or wherever you find your podcast. For today, I'm Marisa Lagos. We'll see you tomorrow.